start us off by telling us a little bit about who you are, where you grew up, where you're from, how did you get to where you are at the moment? What was your life journey?
I was born in Beirut in 1960, a long time ago. Spent the first 15 years in Lebanon. Typical Arab extended family, aunts and uncles and cousins. Went to a school called International College, which was and probably remains one of the great schools in Lebanon.
Well known, IC.
IC, that's it. I was an IC student. Yeah. Started there at KG1. Met some friends with whom I'm still in touch still today. So amazing. That's nearly 50 years or 60 years now, nearly. Yeah, I still keep in touch with a couple of them. And then just grew up the normal life, joined the Boy Scouts, got interested in football, as people do. And then it all came to a halt in 1975 when the war broke out in Beirut, in Lebanon. Fortunately, my father, may he rest in peace, was living in Oman at the time. He was working. So we had a safety net. So we went to Oman. A year later, I was sent to the UK to study at one of the English public schools, which is actually very private, but I don't know, they still call it public school.
Yeah, they have that there.
It's a public school, but it's actually very private. So I did 3 years of schooling.
Alone?
It was a boarding school.
Okay.
And then I did my degree, and then I did my postgraduate, and I started working in Oman in February 1984. I joined a very solid group called the Zubair Group. Learned a great deal. I spent 3.5 years there.
You joined them as what?
I joined them as a commercial officer, which is basically the bottom of the heap in the commercial department and the head office. My first boss was a very kind American called Dick Novak. And basically it was charged with doing business development, bringing in agencies for the rest of the group, supporting on the marketing and so on and so forth. So that in itself, because of the diversity of the work, was great education. Got married during that period and came up to the UAE in 1987. Spent 7 years doing different jobs with different entities. And in 1994, I joined Masoud for the first time. In something that was called the Engineering Products Division. My boss was someone called Robert Schwartz, who then went on to become the first COO of the group later on. Did a year of that, and then I was sent to Alain, where I was given at the age of 35 the chance to become GM for the first time. I ran a company called Timco, for close to 15 years.
Wow.
Back to Abu Dhabi, doing different things. And then I left in 2013, spent about 7 years doing different things. And when the first opportunity came to rejoin the group, I grabbed it with both hands, came back in 2020 and took the current role in 21. So that's
what's the current role?
That's 40 years of life there. My title is CEO Group Industrial, which looks after 7 different business units, which are quite diverse. But my job is or my responsibility is to look after those 7 business units. Each has its own GM. And within the Masoud philosophy, as I mentioned, we always empower the GM as much as we can. So my role is to be advisor, co-strategist, challenger, mother confessor, friend, assistant GM, and to basically just support those seven capable leaders to keep moving forward and pushing them where necessary, sometimes advising them if they're trying to go too fast, but basically having faith in them, like the organization does, to actually implement a certain vision that we're going towards. So my role is interesting because, on the one hand, on any given day I've got seven different lines of business to think about, but on the other I'm actually supported in this by seven very capable people. So this is my job. It's very hard to explain. You know, like the CEO of automotive runs automotive, the CEO of property runs property. I run with seven different things. So that's what I do.
The way you described it seems very non-egoistic for me. If somebody says, you know, you can have somebody that says, I'm a group CEO or a CEO of multiple organizations, of multiple CEOs, and I am the boss. I tell them what to do and they get to do what I say. But the way you described it is it's not just a one-way relationship. It's a two-way relationship in order for them to thrive. That's the most important thing, which is, believe it or not, I've worked and interviewed many, many people in these positions, and they don't describe it the way you described it. Has that changed throughout your journey, or is that something you came to a realization to now that you are managing a bunch of CEOs, has always been kind of your ethos in leadership?
No, this is probably new to me. In earlier lives, in earlier roles, where I had the direct line responsibility, I was probably a lot more prone to the dictatorial tendency, if you like, of, you know, I'm responsible, therefore this is the way it's going to be, and that's the end of it. But where that appeared was probably when I had a weaker team around me. Like Timco was a perfect example where we started and the team wasn't as strong as it should have been. So I tended to be quite dictatorial. But as we brought in really capable people to fill different roles, it probably became more of a general consensus to do things. And there were people there. There were some engineers. There were some operations. There were some purchasing people who were just superb. And I was just so thrilled to bring them in. But if you bring in a talent and you recognize that talent, then why do you want to overrule the talent? Why don't you listen to it and bring it into the circle, the inner circle of what you want to do? Discuss, give them time to object, let them challenge. At the end of the day, you say, okay, it's my head. Therefore, it has to be my call. So you make the judgment call, but at least listen to people. As you go into a different direction like I am now, where we have people who are obviously so capable to manage the micro of the management, why do you want to overrule them? Why do you want to upset them? Why do you want to challenge them? And ultimately, why do you want to give yourself this risk that at the end of the year, if a particular business unit hasn't performed to the extent that it should be performing, you come and say, well, you know, you've underachieved. And the first reply would then be, well, you didn't let me manage. So let the manager manage. Advise, consult, challenge, have a few fights. It's okay. But let the person manage.
You said a key word there, which is listen.
Yeah.
Right? The art of listening, or the skill of listening, is being lost as we go with time. How do you define listening? When you say listen to your leaders, listen to your heads, listen to your managers, your directors, GMs, what does listening mean to you?
Literally giving them the chance to put their case. We had a perfect example this morning where I was telling you before we started that a lot of the GMs who are actually on leave today did not stop themselves from contacting me this morning or me contacting them, which is worse, to discuss certain things. Now, one of them said, listen, since you have some time, I want to tell you about something that I'm thinking about. And he told me about a concept that he wants to do. And the minute he said it, my first instinct was, good God, no. No. What are we doing? But I have to give him the respect to listen to him, put his case. I came back with no, for the following reasons. He came back with yes, but. And we ended up sort of getting to a compromise where we agreed to do some preliminary research, which may change my mind, which may change his mind, but at least I've listened. And at least he listened, that he went from sort of full head on and me with a full no to a compromise to say, okay, let's do this and then see where we are. You have to, so listening is letting your trusted colleagues put their case through, arguing, no doubt, challenging, but, show their respect and listen, because what they want ultimately is the same thing as you, which is to maximize the benefit to the organization. We may be coming at it from two different points of view. Sometimes there's a compromise, like maybe this morning. Sometimes there isn't. If I have to say no way, I hope I'm doing it in a nice way or in a nicer way than I used to do in the past.
One thing I admire about people like you is the ability to still improve on oneself as you go. Because obviously from what you're saying, your descriptions of before and now, is that there has been a progressive, I wouldn't say improvement, but growth. What would you say to people that are so stuck in their mindset that they don't believe they need to grow?
I don't know how consciously I made the change. I think I probably just did it maybe against my instincts at the time. I think time changes people. Experience changes people, whether we realize it or not. Because experience, by definition, just opens up the sum total of what's there. And therefore, whether we change because we want to change, where we make a conscious decision that, I'm going to change ABC, or we change organically because of experience, of different circumstances in life. I honestly don't have, if somebody comes to me and says, well, what I'm doing is absolutely right and I'm never going to change, I'll say, okay. I'm not going to get into this argument with anybody. How did I change? I think because I got more experience. I learned, hopefully. That's it. I never set out to... I don't want to say I never set out to improve myself, because that sounds really silly. But I never
set out... I don't think that's true either.
I never set out to sort of change that way. But I think my style of management, my tolerance of argument probably has evolved because of experience, because of different circumstances. I can't put a finger on it.
That's okay. Well, I mean, that is a finger on it. It's experiential change. Yeah. So it's just changing with experiences of life, I guess. I mean, I feel like people underestimate that change because it feels reactive rather than proactive. But at the end of the day, it is a strategy of change. You have adapted and changed yourself and grew yourself according to your experiences in life. That doesn't mean that a lot of people or some people can do that. There are people that are very stuck in their ways. And I'm sure people like that are very stuck in their ways, because they don't see that they need to change or they don't want to. And therefore, they are stuck because they think that they are right. This kind of dictatorship philosophy that I'm right, what I say is right, and whatever I say is has to go. And that type of leadership, unfortunately, does not, or fortunately, let's say, does not work anymore. You cannot, especially with the new generations, you cannot not listen. You cannot not give them the respect of giving their voice, because I think probably my generation is the last generation that was kind of okay with dictatorship to a certain level. But if we are to look towards the future and the future generations, according to what the how we're progressing, it's very hard to tell them what to do. They have to be convinced of what we're asking them to do.
Yeah.
And so the old style of leadership does not kind of resonate with them anymore. These are the kind of like perspectives that I like to understand, and I like to, and since you said that you were one day a dictator, you described yourself that way.
Okay.
Of dictator, let's say, tendencies, qualities.
Yes.
Okay. And now you are a lot less that. I just want you to be able to share some wisdom to people, for people that are struggling with that, because a lot of the people I work with are struggling with that. How can they let go? How can they lead through example? How can they lead by allowing their leaders to lead, by trusting, by listening? How can you make that shift?
Okay, two things. One is, I want to talk about the generational thing, because I'm not sure if this is a generational evolution that we're going through in terms of the response to management styles. Dictatorship at the heart of it, and I'm not defending it, but dictatorship at the heart of it is somebody taking responsibility. Somebody saying, listen, I'm going to make that call and I will stand by the result of that call, whichever it is. This is part of it. The other part of it, which is not to be encouraged, is not listening, et cetera, but ultimately it's about somebody making a decision to say, we're going to do this investment, or we're going to take a suicidal price on this particular job because I want it for strategic reasons, but somebody making a call. That in itself is not a bad thing. Having the heart to actually make a decision on a business is not a bad thing in itself. And that's something that I hope I haven't lost as I try to progress in my life. But the best thing about, the best way to approach making a decision is, again, listen. Look at the possibilities. Look at the pros and cons as objectively as you can. And the best way to do that is to have a team around you of people that you genuinely think are better than you. You know, this is what I was trying to do.
That's
in TIMCO.
The point. Yes.
In TIMCO, I always said to, you know, I'd be interviewing people and I would say to them, you know, I love your brain. I think it's fantastic. Come and work with us. Because deep down, I thought, this guy is so much better than me in engineering. So this guy is so much better than me in procurement. Bring people who you think are better than you. Bring people with strong personalities. There's nothing wrong with having strong personalities around you, people who will challenge you as much as you challenge them. As long as it's done with a modicum of respect and appreciation and friendship. But there is nothing wrong with having strong personalities. There's nothing wrong with having people who you think are just so good at what they do. And then once you bring them in, we come back to what I said before. Why don't you listen to them? Yes, make your call if you're the leader. But listen. Listen to what they have to say. Listen to their point of view, because they will approach it differently. An engineer will approach a solution differently from, say, a finance guy. An HR guy will approach it differently from a manufacturing guy. Mm. Listen to the points of view. form your opinion. If you're the leader, make the call, and it is your call. And they have to know that it is your call.
Absolutely.
So to me, if that's dictatorship, then yeah, great. You know, but what I tended to do was because I didn't maybe have the confidence in myself to actually trust their judgment when I first got introduced to them, or because circumstances, as I saw them at the time, dictated this. I said, okay, this is what we're doing, and I will stand by my decision. And fortunately, I had a chairman, who Mr. Abdullah Al-Mas'ud, may he rest in peace, who always backed up the manager. And again, this is part of the Mas'ud philosophy, that even when you did something and it turned out to be a bit of a disaster, you knew that you were not going to be asked that, you know, why did you do it? The question was always going to be, what have you learned? What have you learned from your mistake? Okay. And this has been the philosophy that I've been very fortunate to work in within Al Mas'ud both times. And this is what we applied, because Timco, for example, was very evolutionary in what we tried to do. So I always said to them, even if you're going to make engineering mistakes, operational mistakes, it's okay. Once, you're forgiven. No problem. Don't do it again. Go and learn from it. But coming back to your question, how do you evolve from one state of mind into another state of mind? If you're fortunate enough, like I am today, to have around me those seven GMs, but also a good support system, okay? And you know that these guys represent the best in the business that they're doing, and the support team is there to help. Why don't you listen? Listen, argue, disagree, challenge, have a few shouting matches. But at the end of the day, if you're going to make a call, make the call, but at least listen.
So one of the key things you're talking about here is to have the experience and intelligence and kind of like the instinct to hire the right people. Because that's step one.
Of course.
Step one is to identify the gaps that you have in your organization. And then step two is to hire the right person without you judging them in any way because of any preconceived notion.
Sure.
And not allowing your ego to get in the way when you're hiring the right person. Maybe they're opinionated, maybe they're strong-willed, maybe all of these things that you spoke about. But put them in place and then give them the respect and allow them to express themselves and to be able to lead, with the caveat that at the end of the day, you're the one that is going to pull the trigger. You're the one that's going to make the decisions.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem like dictatorship to me.
Okay.
That's absolutely, for me, I mean, a leader has to be able to listen, but then a leader has to be able to fulfill the vision of their leaders. So at the end of the day, you're an extension of a leader. You're not at the top of the pyramid. There is somebody that you are held accountable to.
Yes.
So you have to be somebody that is able to make the final call on behalf of everybody. Because at the end of the day, you're also looking out for them by making the right decisions. Quick question.
Sure.
So one thing that's kind of intrigued me while you were talking, and you mentioned it twice, was this eagerness to go back to Al Mas'ud. What makes an organization make you feel that way? A lot of organizations would want their people like you that are an asset to want to come back.
It's home. There's a sense of comfort in being part of the organization. Now that reflects many things. That reflects the way that we look after people. And now I will say we, that we look after people in terms of not just the salary and you know, but It's just the way we look after people, the training that's available that I always I'm quibbling against because it takes away some of the work time of my colleagues. But the fact that Masoud has always been interested in learning and development for the staff, the development of their own personal skills. It's home. It's somewhere where you're working in a safe environment, in a comfortable environment, where you're home. I mean, how can you explain home except that it is safety and comfort? And because it's home and because it's family, you then go way out of your way to achieve and then overachieve if you can, because you're doing it for your own family. And I'm not saying it because I'm now in a senior position. I wasn't always in a senior position. But whether it's me, whether it's somebody who's just joined to do a mechanics job or to do anything, we all very quickly develop this sense of home. Recently, we had the Stars Award, and one of the things that they did was they honored, I think, three members of staff who were celebrating the 35th year working for Al Masoud.
Wow.
A lot of us are there for a long time because we're comfortable in what we do. So why are people comfortable? Because it's home to a lot of us, because there's genuinely a sense of family. And I refer to it as family wherever I go. I say, you know, somebody joins whether in directly working with us or somebody else. And I always greet them by saying, welcome to the family. This is the short answer. I'm not going to overdo it. It's to me, it's home.
Good enough. So you left and you came back,
yeah.
Right? When you left, what was different in that specific feeling? I'm saying, why aren't people retained? So it's the opposite of the question that I asked before.
I spent most of my first period working for the private office of Mr. Abdullah Al-Masoud. And the time that I left, which was 2013, first of all, I wasn't really that attached to the main group where I'm working now. But I basically thought that I had reached the end of the line in terms of what I could achieve within the private organization. And it seemed that maybe the grass was greener doing other things outside. In many ways, I thought that I was way too much in my comfort zone after 20 years. And I just wanted to do something different. The day I went to say goodbye to him, he said to me, don't be a stranger. You know, let's see you. And he was, and next time I met him, he was, you know, it was all very friendly and very courteous. What was different then to today? The organization went through a big change, I think, 2017. And I'm talking about Masoud LLC. And a lot of the philosophies were formalized. So even though we had a lot of these very good philosophies before, maybe they were not formalized as much as they are now. But also we become a lot more corporate. Compliance was introduced as part of the governance rules. HR was formalized into a much bigger operation that involves a lot of screening and so on, and learning and development and so on. Marcom came in, and from the ground up, it was built up. So it's a lot more corporate, but the basic values that I'd known Masoud's back in 94 are still there. And this is why it's still home.
That's just amazing.
Yeah.
Really, to be able to maintain that at the growth rate that you guys have. Mm. I mean, it's quite... it's quite interesting because I've spoken to many of the leaders of Al Masoud right now, and it seems like that is not just something that is just paying kind of lip talk or whatever whatever the expression is. I don't know what
it is. No, it's a reality.
The values are really embedded into everything you
get.
And I like the way you said it. You said the philosophy was formalized.
Yeah.
That's what you said. What does that mean?
When I knew Masoud's obviously well before I joined them, because I'd been living in Abu Dhabi since more or less since 87, and I joined Masoud in 94. So everybody knew Al Masoud and the big name and everything. And if you spoke to people on the outside then, the consensus was they're good people. This is it. I mean, there wasn't, it was, they're good people. So I was eager to join. When the opportunity came, I just jumped in. And it helped that I knew Robert, who was to be my first boss. I knew him from before. But again, very quickly, you fall into the system that you join. Within 2-3 days, this is done. The car allowance is issued. It's all automatic. It's all like this. And then you say, who do I have to get approval to do this? Approval? Why do you need approval? You're empowered. Go do it.
Since those days.
And they were almost offended that I was asking about these questions. Wow. So there is this sort of natural philosophy that I encountered from 94, encountered in a nice way, from 94. And it went on. What has happened now is that, yes, we have systems, we have application forms, and we do all of this. So, but it is still the same way of looking after you. You ask for something, it's done quickly. If it's not done quickly, you actually go and object and it gets sorted. But the other elements of the philosophy, which is the empowerment, especially as divisional managers or unit managers, that hasn't stopped, because the new structure allows this. The new structure relies on this. The structure that we've had since 2017 with our present board of directors, if anything, they've enshrined this philosophy that the CEOs are empowered, the GMs, and we have a full manual of authority enshrining this empowerment. So it's the old philosophy has now been enshrined as part of the system. And it's great. Sometimes you rail that, you want even more authority. Okay, go and talk to them and talk to the directors and say, listen, I need this. Yeah, go ahead, do it. There's an element of natural trust between the directors and the executives, which is exactly what I knew in 94. It's still the same philosophy. There's trust in you. We're hiring someone, trust him. And this is what I've tried to do. You hire someone, trust him or trust her to do the job. Where you see things going wrong, say so. But also listen to the reply, because what you might be seeing might be, one way, the person might be seeing it totally differently. And you have to respect that person is in the field, is in the operation. So while you can see it, you can see the wood from the trees, as they say, listen to the guy inside the trees as well, because, he might have a totally different point of view.
Mm. It's a lot of people, I think, don't understand the context of these founding leaders that we had here at a time when we had nothing, really.
Yes.
And their inherent wisdom or their inherent knowledge that they came in to build these organizations and to build this country the way it is. I'm very often very curious. And in a way, I'm kind of jealous from people that have actually sat with them and interacted with them and spoke to them and felt their presence when it comes to leading in a way that wasn't necessarily taught to them in school or by text. It's just a natural extension of what they were before all of this came. How Because a lot of people, when they look at this region, they think that there was nothing before what we had now. That there wasn't inherent wisdom, that there wasn't great leadership, that there wasn't all of that. There was just poverty and people in the desert, and you know, life was very, very different, like the Wild Wild West. But in or the Wild Wild East, that's called it. Wild Wild Middle East.
Wild Wild Middle East.
But if you have anything to share of the times you've sat with Mr. Mas'ud, Allah yarhama, and what did you feel from a human scale perspective? What did instinct. You feel in terms
of... The word is instinct.
Yes.
That, I mean, I've been dying to jump in with that word. I had the benefit of working with both Mr. Rahma al-Mas'ud, Allah yarhamah, and Mr. Abdullah al-Mas'ud, Allah yarhamah. More so with Mr. Abdullah because I ended up in his private grouping. But I still saw Abu Jaber from time to time. Why did they succeed? Because I think maybe they didn't have the formal education that we have since had. But a lot of it was instinct. My reporting to Mr. Abdullah was that I would once a month come into his office for 10-15 minutes, and that was it. Financials would be sent through to the private office. We never discussed them directly. But I would go in to see him maybe 10 minutes a month, sit down across, you know, the little office that he had in Mas'ud. And I would just sort of reel off and say, listen, what we're doing in general, no details, just, you know, we're going into this country, we're going, you know, we're doing this, we're about to introduce this new product. And he would listen. And sometimes he would say, you know, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And that was it. But when I would go to him for the big decisions, like when we decided to set up a factory in Jordan, out of all places, you know, we were in Alain, and we decided to set up another facility to get business into Iraq at the time. We prepared our business plan and we ran it through financially, and we got the advice of a number of people. Then I went in to see him holding this gigantic folder. And he said, what's this? And I said, this is the business plan for Jordan. He said, just put it aside. He looked me in the eye and he said, do you think we should do it? In the eye. And I said, yes, sir. He said, okay, approved.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. There was an inbuilt instinct. And I'm not the only one. And I'm not saying this to say, you know, what a fantastic relationship I had with him. But I'm saying a lot of the decisions that were made based on an inherent instinct for business, for knowing what the country needs, knowing what Abu Dhabi needed beyond Abu Dhabi. And you would have a chat with them and say, do this. And I know from other GMs at the time that a lot of the investment that took place was undertaken with this instinctive decision by Mr. Abdullah. So how did they manage? Well, look at the results. I mean, from Sheikh Zayed onwards, I don't think they had much time anyway to sit and ponder and you know. So I think a lot of it had to be instinct. Obviously, there was a mercantile history and background to the country, which got ingrained into their mentality. But they had instinct and they had the bravery, again, to make a decision and to say, that's it, we're going to go down that road, let's go. And it's admirable. And people today may forget just how big the transformation was from the 70s into the 80s. I mean, when I first came here in 87, I now think back of how, say, Dubai looked and how it looks today. But even in 87, there was magnificent stuff being, you know, World Trade Center was already up and so on and so forth. So these early decisions, Jabal Ali Port was already going in Dubai, Emirates Airlines, I think was Emirates Airlines was already established. These are momentous things And then you look at what Abu Dhabi was doing at the time as well. And these were decisions that were taken by very brave, instinctive leaders to set the path going on a national scale and in Masoud scale as well.
Yes. I mean, I'm very keen for people to not forget that, to not forget how quickly and how exponential the growth has been. I was born in 78 here, and I remember as a child what it was like. I very, very vividly. I mean, I was a teenager in the 80s, so I remember what it was like and what we had in comparison to just 40 years down the line, 50 years down the line. What teenagers have now is a completely different story. I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine, Abdullah, yesterday about, he's exactly 10 years younger than me.
Right.
About how they grew up and how I grew up. And just in these 10 years, there's a drastic difference. Very, very big difference in how, what they had and what we had and how that's affected us differently growing up. So thanks for sharing that. It's always so valuable to have that perspective.
Yeah, you need the older guys to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you read Rags to Riches?
Yes, I have.
I think anybody who really needs yet another demonstration should read that book.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I'm often asked, who is your favorite leader? And always, without a doubt, it's Sheikh Zayed, Allah yarhamah. Just because everything I believe in terms of physically, metaphysically, spiritually, he just fits this kind of dimension of a person that had a vision and was able to manifest this vision. Whatever you believe in terms of what this reality is, how we manifest things, how we bring things into reality, whether you believe in it from a spiritual perspective, because he was a very spiritual human being, or whether you believe in it in a active making things happen, making decisions, making instinctual decisions and things like that. Or you believe that he's somebody that is super magical human and believed in what a human being is and what a human being can, and empowering people. I think he really resembles all of these things in a very peaceful, masculine, caring man, you know, that I think I'm also these days really studying masculinity and manhood and what that actually means. And I think there's so much to be learned from that generation here in particular. And I'm worried that is getting lost over time, that there is something, like you said, there needs to be a philosophical transference of some way. I would love to see for that to happen from a philosophical perspective, how to study these people and kind of formalize in an educational manner somehow to transfer that kind of knowledge, because that knowledge is not necessarily where I see it might be difficult is that knowledge isn't necessarily educational in its way of delivery from them. And so I would love for somebody to kind of study it and make it an official material to be delivered to leaders to explain a different side, because a lot of times it wasn't very pragmatic. It wasn't very, like you said, it came out of necessity. It came out of instinct. It came out of actual need. And we seem to have a lot more time these days when we are leading and we're making these decisions, a lot more and a lot less necessity, let's put it that way, because we're thriving. We're in a time of thriving rather than surviving. And I feel like it kind of shifts the mindset of a leader a little bit to have that, as you're saying, that comfort zone versus having the survival, the instinctual need to survive. How do you feel about that?
My instinct is to disagree with what you said.
Okay.
I think the nature of the challenges change with time, but the necessity to solve them remains, albeit, you know, different challenges. I think where the United Arab Emirates was from 71 onwards, or even before, but let's take 71 onwards, and a lot of these decisions, these pioneering decisions that had to be made, were made based on necessity, et cetera, that you talked about. But today, I believe we're still seeing the same philosophy that Sheikh Zayed, that Sheikh Rashid came with, still being maintained by the president, the vice president, in terms of leading. And I don't want to talk about politics. I'm not a political man, but you still see the philosophy. You still see the benevolence. I'll give you one example that to me just sums up a lot of why I'm saying the philosophy continues. COVID came, it was dealt with. We then went back to some modicum of openness, and then vaccination came. And the stunning thing was this, and I wasn't surprised by it because I've lived here for many years, so I know the fabric. But when the vaccination came, nobody ever said to anyone, the priority is going to be for Emiratis. Nobody said that. The priority was get in your car, get on a bus, do whatever, go and get vaccinated, no matter who you are. And that, to me, summed up a lot of why people love this country, why people love living in this country, that you were very much made to feel at home. That philosophy, again, I use the word home, that philosophy is exactly what you saw from the early days, and it's being continued by the present leadership. I don't think the philosophy has changed. I don't think the approach to problem solving has changed. If anything, the world has become more complicated. I think the challenges have become more complicated. And the way that they are being dealt with are very much rooted in what Sheikh Zayed, Sheikh Rashid started with from 71 onwards. And that's why my instinct was to say, I'm not sure that we're losing this tradition. If anything, I think this tradition is very much still in play, albeit responding to a much more different world than it was 50 years ago.
I mean, maybe I phrased it wrong. I don't think I don't think we're losing it. Absolutely not. But the people that are leading were privileged to be around it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What I'm saying is this dissemination, because with time, these things, you know, with time, these things kind of separate, this exposure separates. And I'm not talking about now, I'm talking 50, 100 years from now. What I would like to see is some kind of pragmatic approach to instill that in people, to teach that to people, so that it's not lost. I know I by no means saying it's lost now. I'm just saying it has to be safeguarded in a way and treasured in a way that it is formalized. Like you said, formalizing a philosophy, that it's formalized so it is taught from the early years, and it has a pragmatic approach to teaching it, to teach that philosophy in a sense. Let's change gears a little bit, and I'll ask you another question.
Sure.
So just talking about, you know, my idols growing up were, I said who it is, the leadership here, and specific Sheikh Zayed. And I remember when I was a child, I was walking on the Corniche. I think I was about maybe 9, 10 years old. My dad used to love walking on the Corniche every day. That was his exercise. So every once in a while, I'd take that boring walk with him on the Corniche. It wasn't very exciting. But one day, Sheikh Zayed passed by in his car. And, you know, he traveled just in his car. Yeah. And he waved at me. And I literally, that was the best moment, I think, yeah. for me until today.
Yeah.
Until today, that I had this like eye contact with him was amazing. And then on a different occasion, I had a meeting in Mubadala one day, in the Mubadala building. And this is when I left the government and went into corporate. And the company I used to work for are a multinational in the UK. So I was their GM in the region. And one of their representatives was here. We were sitting having lunch and Sheikh Mohammed came in and sat right on the table next to us. He couldn't understand what was going on. It wasn't functioning. He came, just sat normally with Khaldun Mubarak and a few people. They were just having a conversation downstairs in the restaurant downstairs. I forgot what it was called. Jones the Grocer.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, when he walks in, everybody gets up out of respect. And as he was leaving, we got up. So he was in the table right next to us. I got up and he stopped. And he looked at us and said hello to him and said hello to me. Had a conversation with me for 5 minutes. That was another huge moment for me. So, you know, we're blessed here that our idols are part of the fabric. Like, yes, they coexist with us. I'm very interested to ask and to understand from you who your idols were. That were, I don't like that word idols, but you know, who did you look up to when you were younger that were larger than life personalities?
Nothing as grand as what you told me, but my grandfather, I idolized my grandfather until he passed away in 72. So I was 12 years old, but I truly idolized him, and he gave a lot of love back. So I spent a lot of time with him. I listened to every word he had to say about anything in life. Apart from that, I can't now think of who was an idol after that period. In terms of somebody giving me wisdom or somebody that I looked up to, maybe it's just me, but I never did.
Was about him that made you feel that way?
Apparently, I was the first son of the only son to him, and that was very important to him. So from a very young age, he would call our house and just order my poor mother to send the boy over so he can spend time with him. So I just spent time around him, basically, whether he was, you know, peeling apples or just telling me stories or making me listen to his brand of music. It was just Jiddu, it was just granddad. And as I got older, I would sort of accompany him on shopping trips, you know, buying groceries and what have you. And that was a thrilling time for me. I was spending time with my granddad. And he had a wicked sense of humor, which is always welcome. It was love. That was it. So he was my big hero.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I never had that. I never met any of my grandparents.
I met him. I don't remember the one on my mother's side, okay, because he passed away very early on in my life.
Okay.
But I was fortunate enough that I knew both grandmothers as well. Granddad was the idol.
Yeah. Music.
Yeah.
You mentioned that. I mean, out of everything that you mentioned about him, music was the first thing that popped up. What kind of music was he listening to, and how did he influence
you? The family was highly into music in the sense that a few of them played oud and sang. And at the time, I mean, this is early 60s, but I saw it all the way up to maybe the early 80s as that generation passed away. There were some good singers among them. A few of them played oud. And then they were all into the music of the time, which is Umm Kulthum, Abdul Wahab, even going, you know, there were some references at the time I did not understand, but you know, they would sing songs by a guy, and I said, who is this guy, Karim Mahmoud? And then later on in life, I discovered what he had done. So Arabic music, obviously, some early Fayrouz, some early Rahbani brothers, and this was his genre. And then when the family got together, it was more of the same. It was Abdul Wahab, Umm Kulthum, etc.
Playing music together.
Playing oud and singing quite sometimes out of tune, but you know, nobody cared as long as they were together. But it was this love of music, and it was this love of the 78s at the time. It wasn't even the LPs, it was 78s on his big Grundig. And then once a month they would listen, he would put the radio on and listen to Umm Kulthum doing her monthly concert from Cairo. And that sort of then transferred onto my father, who loved music as well. And at a very young age, he made me go with him to see in Beirut in the summer for the cinemas to drum up business in the afternoon, because everybody's up in the mountains or on the beach. They started running festivals of Muhammad Abdul Wahab films. And I think he'd made, I don't know, about 10 films. And my father was just totally enamored with the idea of taking me at the age of 11, 12, 13, when I didn't understand any of this, to go with him to the cinema to watch Abdul Wahab films. But I, you know, I picked up a song or two that I'm still fond of till today. So that love of music then transferred onto my father in particular, and then onto us, the children, and then onto my children. And, you know, we love music. I can't play any instrument, but I still love music.
How important is that?
What, the inheritance or the music?
Both. The inheritance of music.
I think
something again, that's passed down the bloodline.
Yeah, I think again it's I keep using the same word, it's instinctive. How important is music to me? It's quite important. It's one of the few things that take me in a totally different direction on any given day. And I can just get lost in music for an hour or sometimes more. And listening to different things. I mean, there are things that I, you know, there are genres in French that I love, but I'm actually quite open to listening to a lot of other stuff, and I enjoy listening to other stuff, sometimes in languages that I don't understand, but I still like the feel of a song, so I listen to it.
Do you listen to new stuff, to new age stuff, or?
No, I'm quite.
Where did you stop?
I'm a bit of a Luddite, I think.
Where did you stop? What kind of?
I haven't consciously said, you know, I'm not listening to anything beyond 1995 or something.
I understand.
I listen to anything. I'm open to listen to anything. But obviously, what I enjoy is probably limited to a certain time period, maybe. I don't know. Because a lot of the new stuff that I've listened to, take this morning. I was listening to some stuff from the 60s, just getting ready. The obligatory Clapton, of course. Clapton is very important to me. But then I listened I then switched to Arabic music, recent Arabic music, maybe. And then I switched back to listening to Van Morrison. So I listen to anything. I've listened to Tuareg music. I've listened to Qawwali music. I love the blues, as everybody knows. I listen to a lot of Arabic stuff. But just because a piece of music is not to my liking, or subsequently, or just because a piece of music has lyrics which I totally don't understand, doesn't stop me.
Mm. What's your favorite genre?
Blues.
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 Okay.
What Clapton era? Clapton is king for me.
Okay. So what era? 60s, 70s?
The first time I saw him was in 76, and I've followed him ever since. But Clapton has done a lot of blues work. And through that, I got into a lot of blues stuff. I'm now rediscovering a guy called Freddie King, who sort of came to fame very briefly before he passed away young. Very raw, very loud, electric-driven blues. I just love blues music.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you have any recommendations for me where I can start if I'd like to listen to blues?
Listen to Freddie King live and you will thank me.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll take a note of that.
Freddie King, Eric Clapton, Buddy Guy.
Okay.
It's obvious, a lot of it is obviously guitar-driven music. But there are pieces that I love because of the sound of, say, the Hammond organ, which I think is a fascinating instrument. There's a lot of good music about, and it's not necessarily my era of music. I'm sure some of the new stuff is also very good. Maybe I don't get to listen to it often enough. But as I said, I can listen to it, to anything. I can listen to some... what was it the other day I was listening to? I was listening to some bolero music. I've listened to... tango, and there's a derivative of that called malanga from Argentina. So I love music.
I'm like you. I think this is definitely transferred by DNA and subconscious programming, whatever you believe in. But I'm like you. I was born here. Both my parents from Aden. And if you know anything about Aden, it was very progressive. And so the first time I went to Yemen, my dad took me when I was 11. And I remember we went to my aunt's house. We were staying at my aunt's house, and she has like a big majlis where everybody comes and hangs out. And especially that we were, my dad's coming for the first time in like 10, 11 years, something like
big event.
Yeah, a big event. So everybody came, and then within half an hour, everybody picked up an instrument, and I've never been I've never been exposed to it, and every single person played an instrument, boys or girls, it doesn't matter. In our family, there's no separation; we're all sitting together. And girls were playing oud, boys were playing oud. You know, oud is the main thing, of course. Two of my cousins are known to be one of the best awada in Aden. You know, and I was just, I remember being completely shocked that every single person in my family played an instrument and I didn't. But it also explained my love for music. I loved music since I remember. I don't remember ever being separated from music. Mm. And like you, I listen to everything. I'm completely open to everything just because to me it's a form of connection and education that is beyond, crosses borders, crosses ideologies, crosses everything. And I picked up the oud and I learned it very quickly.
Really?
Yeah, very, very quickly. Actually, I've always been kind of musical in a way that I don't like following notes. I follow what I hear.
Yeah.
And all my cousin had to teach me was kind of the scale, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, do. And that was it. And I took off by myself. Unfortunately, I never got very formal training because oud is a very kind of, you know, it needs to be taught also formally. So I was never able to play. I just played for myself to be honest, and for my mom when she was listening. But that was it. But I can identify with this idea of how music within families can be a uniting force. And I love that you mentioned that.
Any instrument, if played well, can just be so thrilling. I mean, I'm just thinking now, I don't know, mind changed to Arabic music. And you listen, you know, talking about oud, you listen to, say, somebody like, there's a Saudi called Abad al-Johar.
Mm. And when
oh my God, the way he plays oud is fantastic. Yeah. Or you jump across to say Lutfi Bushnak out of Tunis. And the way they play the oud, you know, the oud is singing on its own, you know. But it isn't just the oud, it's the qanun, it's sometimes some good nai players. A musical instrument is just wonderful. And it's just, I'm utterly useless at this.
Well, I mean, I don't think you're useless. I'm sure you're not.
Okay, at this, but in terms of learning to play, I never had the discipline to actually learn the scales.
Wouldn't want to?
I would love to if I can make some time. I would love to.
But if it means so much to you.
Yeah.
I mean,
perhaps, yeah.
It's
when retirement finally catches up with me. Maybe.
Yeah, I understand.
But yeah, music is very important. I make time to listen to music. I'm very open to just different things.
Do your children play any instruments? Or?
They both learned guitar when they were young. My daughter learned guitar. Faisal, my son, learned piano. I don't think they haven't kept up. I know for a fact they haven't really kept up with it. But they both, again, like their music. And when they were younger and we used to live in LA, we'd be out driving. And I would force them to play a musical game of identifying songs, which were favorites of mine. And I just forced these poor children in the car to play this game. And I think they still resent it till today. And then at one stage when they got a bit older and they decided not to play the game, I resorted to bribing them.
Always works. Always works. Plan B.
But yeah, they like their music and now when we are on family calls, because both the kids are now living away, there is often reference to music and what have you.
Cool. How old are they now?
My daughter is now 30.
MashaAllah.
She's been resident in the U.S. for a few years, working in Philadelphia. And my son is now 26, 27.
Wow.
And he's living in the U.K.
Okay. Married, kids?
He's married. So officially it's now, it's not officially, practically it's now three kids because we love Olivia to bits. So they're working, they don't have children, but you know, they've sort of settled into their life. Layla is still single, my daughter. Okay.
All right. Have you had any mentors growing up? Or growing through your career?
Yeah, in my first role in Oman many years ago, in 1984, there was a senior in this commercial department, a senior guy called Gautam. And I learned a great deal from Gautam in terms of how to do business, how to approach clients, how to approach principals, generally, how to conduct yourself, how to keep boundaries with various things, and he taught me that again, just automatically by the way he performed, and I would watch him, and then even if I sort of went off the path, he was very quick to say, "No, this is the way you do it," and that mentorship became a friendship, and so. That's probably from the early days. But since then, since coming to the UAE, I wouldn't want to call my relationship with Mr. Abdullah as mentoring because he never sought to sort of teach me things. It was an expectation in the relationship. So I wouldn't call him a mentor. That's it, really. I mean, I'm sure I've learned from many, many people, both senior and junior to me at different parts of life. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I don't think anybody or I consciously sought mentorship. But I learn. I'm happy to learn. I'm happy to observe and to see where things have gone right and what I can do to copy that, or where things have gone wrong and to see what I can do to avoid that. And it doesn't have to be from seasoned professionals. It doesn't have to be from well-educated or well-informed. You just pick up things in life.
How important do you think mentorship is, or how important is it to embed mentorship into organizations like yours? It's a big buzzword at the moment.
Well, it's a problem because... Okay, we'll scratch that. We won't say it's a problem. It's a challenge. Because if I'm now mentoring somebody, the values that we have or the philosophies that we have are very different. Generational thing again. So how far they would listen? I mean, Gautam was maybe 7, 8, 10 years older than me. That was it. So, it wasn't big. But now if I'm mentoring one of the young officers or something like that in the company, I don't know how they would relate. Maybe they would watch me do something and learn from that, and that's fine. So to me, yes, you mentor, you pass on the knowledge, and that's fine. I mean, we're talking about passing on the history, and it's the same thing. So you pass on the knowledge, and that's okay. But how will they react to it? I don't know, because the new generations are very, very set in their way. And how they would react to an old guy saying, you know, this is the best way forward, I don't know. Mm. I'm not against it, but I don't know how to deal with it.
Mm. Interesting.
I don't know if that's politically correct, but no, so that's the truth.
No, it's absolutely politically. So you're saying that you don't feel like you will be relatable to them because
I might be totally irrelevant to them.
Mm. So one of the things that I see is an opportunity missed. I try to choose my words carefully.
Yeah.
An opportunity missed in this world and in the time we're in right now is learning from elders. So throughout human existence, we put elders in a very revered position.
Yes.
Where the ones that were selflessly put in some kind of elderly advisory position in a tribe or, you know, and whatever. Sometimes they refer to them with no offense at all as the gray hairs. I mean, even that name, the gray hairs, has used to be something that is very revered.
Yes.
As something that is a symbol of wisdom and a symbol of somebody that can give back. And there was always this counsel that you would be able to go to and learn from and get guidance from, because there's nothing equivalent to experience. And we've lost that ability to have that in our lives as young people. I still call myself young, but as young people, we've lost the ability to be able to go to older people. Because quite frankly, older people feel exactly the way you feel right now. I don't think we're relevant. I don't think we're valued. And when you say things like that, what you really basically are saying subconsciously is, I don't feel valued for my experience. And we've lost that. And I feel like there is so much lost in this world. And that's why I'm so attached to this idea of, you know, transferring philosophy, making it pragmatic. For the younger generation right now, they can't take more than, research is showing, 10 to 30 seconds of information. And they have to switch, and they have to switch, and they have to switch. Of course, you know, there are certain social media mediums that are making it worse. But our attention to detail, to be able to sit in front of somebody for hours listening to them talk about a certain topic, is becoming very, very, very difficult for the younger generation. Yeah. And I believe that's because we lost that. We lost this ability to keep this inherent intergenerational experience and information alive and have a vehicle for it.
Mm.
And the reason why I'm asking this question is because I feel like it is absolutely important to have that. And this is, a part of humanity that we are losing, that I'm very, very genuinely very sad about, and something that hopefully through this medium I'm going to indicate to people a little bit how important it is to have that in your life. So mentorship to me is a modern way of a translation of what used to be that. Is that it doesn't matter if you're relatable from a perspective of age. To me, what's important is that there are certain wisdoms that cannot be lost. And like you said, it's not about, you know, somebody that's the best manager, and it's not about technical knowledge, and it's not about these things. It's about everything in between that is very important.
The real question is, how do you pass on experience or the benefit of experience? And when we were young, we would hear our parents say, do it this way because I'm telling you it's better. And we would always say no, because we knew better at 22, at 23, etc. We knew better. But I think maybe, and I don't want to have a go at what is it, Gen Z now, or but we had something, maybe we had a different set of circumstances that made us maybe listen without acknowledging it, or maybe just listening to somebody else. The current trend that you see of very short attention to things in general, this is what makes us irrelevant. Because if I'm going to sit down and mentor a 21, 22-year-old and say, listen, I think you should do this because of the following, I don't think it's the loss of attention that it's just a different attitude. It's a different set of values that they have. I'm not saying it is wrong. I'm just saying it's different. So they probably will not want to listen. And the danger with that is, if you don't listen to your elders, whatever that is defined, then you are going to lose a whole bunch of things. And then you will end up paying for it. But again, if you say that to them, they're not going to listen to you.
Yeah, there is, you see, this is where I think that art of elders is lost. Because these elders are not necessarily your parents.
Yeah.
Your parents are always going to be subjective, and you know.
Yeah.
Your parents are always going to be subjective. And it's probably not going to be at the age of them being parents. They're probably grandparents or even great-grandparents. And there are people that understood, like your journey, you are now in a position, in a situation where you understand that this word, I'm using the word that you use, and please with no kind of, with complete openness, and no judgment, is this kind of like dictatorship versus a mentor who's somebody that is going to help you find the answers by giving you a little bit of their journey and a little bit of their wisdom. They're not necessarily going to tell you do this or do that or don't do this or don't do that, because at the end of the day, most of us don't want to hear that. Most of us want to be in a situation where somebody listens to us and gives us a little bit of wisdom, and then we make the choice. That is the difference between mentorship and leadership, or mentorship and managing the situation, and that's the thing that I feel is lost. This ability to go to somebody that is beyond.
In many ways, we're practicing this on a daily basis. This mentorship within my little family, in the sense that I am talking to my colleagues, the GMs, and to others. And it's probably, I wouldn't say a two-way mentoring, but in many ways, they listen to challenges and what have you. And then I'm talking to individuals within the organization on general things. Now, if it is the case that maybe my generation cannot be seen as the mentors to the current, to Gen Z, then maybe the generation after me who are learning this. I don't know. Is there a need for it? We think so. Maybe they don't think so. In terms of bringing forward the inheritance of wisdom. Is it gonna happen? I don't know. Do I think about it much? Not beyond a certain point, no, because you get to a point where you say there's nothing I can do about this, and you know, maybe you're defeatist, I don't know, but you just say there's nothing I can do about this, so you leave it out.
You see, I think that's where this elder kind of, I'd imagine that in a tribe there would be a tent where these elders hung out, and it was just open. And I would imagine that it, you know, you say maybe we can't force them to come, but I am sure if there was an avenue where they came on their own when they needed it or when they wanted to, that there would be. I mean, I know for me and a lot of people I speak to who are of the same mind frame, I'd love access to something like that. I'd love to be able to go to speak to somebody that's been through life and been through business and been through both together. And at some point when I became a parent, at some point when I, you know, now my daughter is only 5, you know, I decided to be a father a bit late. What does that mean? How can I, when my daughter goes to university, I will be at the time of hopefully retirement. So right. I'd be 60.
Right.
You know, 65. What does that mean to me? What should I be looking forward to? What should I be mitigating from now? So you tell me, for example, you know, make sure you're able to move around with them, make sure you're able to save up for them, make sure all of these things that I need answers to, that doesn't necessarily to be very honest with you, exist outside of YouTube. It's not an interactive situation. It's not a place that I can go to, a refuge, let's call it that, of wisdom. It's a very different perspective. The way I see it is it's an open place where people, like a majlis or majlis, where, you know, elders are hanging out and you can go at any moment. To be very honest with you, I really think that would work. And I think it's a lot more needed than even before.
Let me answer you in two ways. I would say mentoring is supposed to be about the elders coaching the next line of leadership primarily, rather than three lines down the line or three rows down the line. And if that is the case, then I think there's a lot of mentoring going on without us even realizing it with you know, with a GM talking to his line, a CEO talking to the GM, so on and so forth. But I don't think mentoring, if it's in the sense of the elders sitting in a majlis somewhere for young people to walk in and listen to them, I don't think that's ever gonna happen. Therefore, if I try to bypass maybe two lines or two generations to get to somebody in Gen Z now and mentor that person, I'm gonna fail. I think if I keep my expectations to one or two generations, I'll be fine, and we're doing it without even realizing it. In terms of a more personal thing, I think there is a mentoring process called the family, because who is going to advise you that, you know, save up for when the university fees hit you, et cetera, et cetera. It tends to be the interfering family. It tends to be aunts and uncles and what have you, whose advice you don't want to hear, but you end up hearing anyway. And it is family, and especially in our part of the world where maybe the family unit is still stronger than, say, elsewhere. Again, I would tend to say that you're probably going through it without realizing it. Mm. That you know, if family, very close friends, are now saying to you, okay, when your kid is ready to go to uni, you're going to be 50, 60, whatever, look at this, look at the university fees, look at all the add-on extras. And family tends to give a lot of advice whether you ask for it or not. And that's just a normal way in our Middle Eastern tradition. So I think there's this. There are plenty of opportunities for mentoring. Sometimes we choose not to see them or not to exercise them. And sometimes maybe we get too ambitious and say, well, we're going to mentor three generations down. No, you're totally irrelevant to three generations down. Mm. Stick to one, go for two, but don't get overambitious. Maybe that's the solution. I don't know. I'm not a great. I don't think I've given it much thought.
This is what we're here. We're here to think about it together. Yeah. It's not. A lot of times, not having the answer is the best thing. So you can enter into dialogue and understand. Maybe give a different perspective. I think one of the things I guess I was trying to say is how you can be conscious of it, rather than it happening automatically, and how important is that to come at it from a conscious perspective, a pragmatic perspective, in an organization, specifically an organization like Mas'ud that's experiencing, and mashallah, knock on wood, an amazing growth spurt at the moment, and they're expanding at a phenomenal rate. How important it is for us to pragmatically, consciously apply that into what we're doing. Because that's when I see with a lot of organizations that I coach at C-suite, where I see at that expansion is one of the risks. The risks is the dilution of your values, the dilution of your growing pains, of doing things. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's important to consciously be aware of that and to consciously have the pieces in place for that not to be diluted as we grow. Because look, I remember the numbers. I think it was something like 3,800 to 4,500 employees by the end of the year, or something like that. I mean, don't quote me. I believe that's relatively the number. You're talking about 700 employees in a year.
More.
And so.
I'm not gonna give away numbers.
No, don't give away numbers.
I'm not supposed to. I will tell you this. I'm going through it personally, with the seven units that we run. Now there are six out of them, out of those seven, are going through a fairly standard growth. You know, we're adding 10%, 15%. One particular operation, we're probably looking to add 30%. 30% this year in terms of headcount, because of the way that they do business. And it's this growing pains. And I mentioned the expression because I've been using it with them, with the GM, to say, okay, this is all fantastic. You know, well done. Fantastic what you're doing. However, we're going to have to change structure probably several times. Not just once, not just, you know, we probably have to change structure several times for the rest of the year.
Not a small change.
I have no issue changing structures, you know, but that means changing procedures. That means, you know, modifying some elements of the ERP, as well as bringing in the people and getting them ingrained into our culture and going through the learning curve with them. But in terms of management, we have to do a lot of changes to account for your success. You know, thank you very much for being successful. You know, look at the pain you're causing me, sort of thing. But coming back to what you're saying is how do you safeguard this culture as the organization grows, or how do you safeguard the procedures and what have you? The fact that they are there is a very good start. That there's something documented, there's a system in place, etc., is a very good start, because you can build on that, and we are building on that. I know I can only speak for my little sub-family. Within that, we're sticking to the rules and as we grow. So as people come in, they, you know, there's an orientation. There's actually orientation session that you have to go through, where you are given orientation on the history and on the value system and the philosophy of the group and the do's and don'ts and so on and so on, and the respect and all of that. And I went through it like everybody else. So as you come in, you're brought into our family philosophy. But how do the organizations react as they grow? Basically by sticking to the rules. We have rules. We have to stick to them. There are approvals. There's a manual of authority. And this is all fine. Then within each of the business units, and again, I'm only talking about mine, what you then have to do is to say, okay, what do I need to change internally? What systems, what procedures, what et cetera, in order to facilitate the growth, knowing that the growth is taking place, knowing that people are coming in who are then put into the stream of life at Mas'ud. So I'm not really worried about growth. If anything, I've been, you know, kicking and screaming, wanting more growth for everybody. Comfortable in the fact that we have a system in place and that the system in place has proven to be very resilient. Does it have to be modified? Of course. Nothing can remain unmodified. But you're talking about modification rather than institution of a system. And that is a major win.
Mm. Man, these conversations, we can keep going. Thank you so much. There's so much wisdom there. Hani, I'm going to ask you a final question.
Sure.
And kind of relevant to our conversation. A person that is moving from senior leadership to super senior leadership. So, I mean, usually we have very privileged to have you here because usually we have, you know, people that are in upper management going into senior leadership positions. But you're kind of surpassed that into group level or you are leading leaders. What is the shift of mindset that needs to happen? What's your advice for somebody that's listening, that's making this, that's very anxious about this move?
Embrace it. Enjoy it. Knowing that you're going to have some tough moments, but knowing that you're going to have wonderful opportunities. I am very privileged in where I am today, not only because I work for a family that I love, but because there is so much diversity in what I do and there's so much scope to grow. When this thing was offered to me, I mean, it took me like 3 seconds to say yes. I think I even interrupted them and said, yes, yes, I'll take it. Because immediately what this allowed me, I don't care about the title. I don't care about any of this. What I care about is that by doing this, I'm actually adding something to the family. So embrace it. If you're offered a chance, grab it. Don't hesitate. Don't dither. Don't say, if, but, I don't know. Take it. Have a strong heart. And then go out and maximize your potential and the potential of those around you. But always remember that nobody's irreplaceable. Don't ever think that you are bigger than the job. Don't ever think that you're bigger than the organization. So stay humble, but go and fight and have fun and enjoy it and embrace it. The world continues to need leaders, continues to need people with strong heart, as we say in Arabic. And the opportunities are there. If you're lucky enough, like I was, to have very strong leaders, very strong support, and fantastic directors to work with. What more do you want?
Beautiful. I like that you incorporated the fact that you need to have fun and enjoy what you're doing because that is lost, I think, in this world somehow. Hani, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you coming in. And hopefully we'll stay in touch.
Inshallah.
Take care.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.